Okay, so we're going to be finishing up in chapter 10 this morning, and then might be able to get over into 11 a little bit, talking about in truthfulness there. But I want to pick up where we left off. We didn't quite finish the last time we were together when we were talking about this this idea of lust. And just a quick reminder, because it's been a few weeks, that what we are talking about is epithymeo, right? Epithymeo is the lust that we are that we're looking at in this passage. When we're talking about, it says that one who looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery in his heart already. And it's about this concept of epithymeo, is this desire for the purpose of consuming, setting your heart after. And that the opposite of lust that we're looking at here is contentment. Okay? Is contentment. Contentment with everything that Christ has done for us, everything that Christ has given for us. Yes, that's part of it. But greater than that is contentment with Christ Himself. And that is the basis of all of the other contentment. And so we talk about that. That's where we really needed to pick up in this discussion, because if we aren't careful, it is very easy to get into the point, to get to the state where what we are content with are all of the material benefits or the relational benefits that Christ gives us in this world, rather than contentment with Him Himself. And this is, and I understand that this is one of those deals, this is like the kudzu of the Christian life, right? We are going to be fighting against this every single day. It is fighting against our nature. And when we're talking about this contentment with material blessings versus contentment with Christ, it's like cutting fingernails or cutting kudzu. And we have to constantly, every day, consciously rein ourselves in. And that's why this is called the cost of discipleship. This is one of those things that it does cost us, and that we have to discipline ourselves consciously, that when we go to Christ and we pray, immediately we are confessing that our nature is to focus on the material. Our nature is to focus on the relational, meaning the relational between us and other people, between us and the world that we live in. And to know that that is where we begin, but we don't want to stay there. And so the last thing we were talking about, the last time we were together, was I used the analogy of looking at our lives as like this big trash can or this big dumpster. And what we want to do a lot of times is try to reach in and dig through all of that to find one good thing, one thing of value, and say, aha, see, I am a good person. There is something here that's of value and of worth that gives Christ a reason for wanting to have a relationship with me, a reason for wanting to redeem me. And that's our nature to do that. But what we really need to be doing is looking at our life overall, looking at our heart, realizing that there is within me, that is within my flesh, no good thing. Now, if the Apostle Paul says that in all of his life of devotion, and he doesn't say that after he's been saved for 6 months or 5 years. This is when he is toward the end of his ministry. He's been a faithful apostle of Jesus Christ for over 20 years. And he says, there is within me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing. It's okay to say that. It's okay. In fact, it's the only way to be honest. And it's encouraged that's where we start. Man, I know that I'm not bringing anything into this. And Lord, I'm here this morning, and I want to thank You for everything You've done for me and everything You provided for me. But I know that that's not the way I'm supposed to be focusing. And I was talking to a person. Let's see, I'm trying to think. Was it this? I guess it was week before last, about this idea of confession. Right? Because when we confess things, when we think about this word confession, There are two contexts in which we think about this word confession. What are the two most common contexts in which we use this word? What are the two rooms in the world? In the world, there are two rooms where you get a confession.
In a Catholic church.
Okay, yes, you get it in the confessional in the Catholic church, right? So you go into this little room, and you got the little screen in between, and over here sits the priest, and over here sits the parishioner, and they come in and they make their confession, right? Just take my word for it, Lanice. It's two stick figures. Hush yourself. All right? So you have the confessional, and then where's the other place that we think about confession? And the police, yes, no one ever gets to the courtroom. It's in the police station, and they put the big light on them, right? And they play good cop, bad cop, and they finally come in and they confess. And in both of those cases, what's being confessed? Sin. Sin of some sort, sin or a crime, okay? We got to get out of that, all right? Because that is such a small part of confession. Confession is any time that I open up and I speak truth about something that I don't want to talk about, okay? So one of the biggest things that we have to learn to confess in the Christian life is weakness and failure. Not even necessarily sin when I say failure. But when I come to Christ and I say, I am completely insufficient for this work. I am completely inadequate. And I am too weak to do these things. In fact, if you go back and you start reading the Psalms, you find that a large, now I'm going to say a majority, but maybe 20, 25% of the Psalms are David or the other authors confessing, I am so lowly. I cannot do the things that you have called me to do. And if it's not for your grace, if it's not for your mercy and your patience and your strength and your power and your glory, I am undone. As Isaiah says in Isaiah chapter 6. So, and it's okay to do that. In fact, this is where, if you'll remember back to the acronym for prayer, ACTS. Y'all remember this? When you're, if you're trying to think about a way to set up your prayer life, what is A?
Adoration.
What is C? Confession. What is T?
Thanksgiving
or thankfulness, that's right. And what is S? Supplication. Right? So supplication, this is where you get down to where you're actually asking for specific things, things that you need. But you get here into confession, and here's the thing. The more you spend time in adoration, and when you look at the Psalms, this is what happens. David is praying a psalm, and he is adoring God in all of His majesty and His wonder, and he immediately goes into confession, not necessarily for sin, but just for inadequacy and weakness and all of these things. And so when we do that, when we put ourselves, it brings our mind into a right focus, a true focus of what we're really bringing or not bringing to the table, to the relationship, but it also magnifies the grace and the goodness of God. So I want you to look at this, something I've been working on this week. Go to Ephesians chapter 1 real quick. I have been working for, I don't know, a month and a half, something like that, on Scripture memorization, really trying to focus hard on Scripture memorization for the purpose of sanctification and my relationship with Christ. And what I mean by that is not just memorizing Scripture because it's, you know, memorizing Holy Shakespeare, but hiding His Word in my heart that I might not sin against God. And so Ephesians chapter 1 is the big one that I'm working on right now. I started on some Psalms, and And then I took off, and I think I've just about got all of Ephesians chapter 1 memorized. But in the course of that, as I'm focusing on these words, I'm trying to set them in my mind, there are certain words now that just jump out of the page at me. All right, so look down at verse. I'm going to find it in this particular page. Look down at verse 12. That we should be to the praise of His glory, who first trusted in Christ. Now, when I sit and I just think about this idea, that we, our lives, are the praise of His glory. This is where that comes in. The more I'm adoring Him, the more I'm realizing the glory that He has, and the little glory that I bring, my life becomes a praise to that glory. And that ultimately is the whole purpose in everything else. That's what comes out in this chapter as a whole. That everything that Christ is doing, everything that God is doing through Christ, is done for the glory of His grace. Look up at verses 5 and 6. Having predestinated us unto the adoption of children by Jesus Christ to Himself, according to the good pleasure of His will. Now look, this is why He did this. This is why He chose us for adoption as His children. It was by the good pleasure of His will, but this is why. To the praise of the glory of His grace, wherein He hath made us accepted in the Beloved. So it's all about the praise of the glory of His grace. Everything. Everything. When I'm talking about everything, I'm not just talking about everything in Justin's life, everything in the life of everyone who is at Marble Hill, everything in the life of every Christian. I'm talking about everything in the universe. Every atom in the universe and every second of time has existed for this purpose, for the praise of the glory of His grace. And so the more we are adoring and the more we are confessing, adoring His sufficiency and His majesty, confessing our weakness and our inadequacy and our failures, the more we're doing that, the more we are bringing praise to the glory of His grace. And you say, what in the world have you got off on this huge tangent? No, it's not off on a huge tangent. This all goes right back to what we're talking about in this section in Matthew chapter 5. This whole idea of being content in everything that God does, that contentment comes when we begin to understand even what would seem to be the most simple grace in our life, the most simple blessing, whether it be material or relational, the fact that I can fathom the existence of Jesus, that He is even there, the fact that God has revealed Himself through the creation, the fact that God has revealed Himself through the creation is enough. I mean, that's mind-blowing in and of itself, that God created this entire universe, but then made Himself known to us. Let us know that He was there, that it is not just this watch, this magnificent Swiss timepiece that He wound up and sat down and backed away. No, He has revealed Himself so that we know that He exists. But then you go beyond that. And not only did He reveal Himself that He exists, but He communicates. He communicates with human beings on this tiniest of specks in the smallest corner of the vast universe, and God communicates to those people even after they rebel against Him. And then you take that a step further, and you know, this is why everything we're talking about this morning, this is why Christmas is so significant. We're going to go in there, and there's this big thing up on the screen that says, Jesus is the reason for the season. What in the world does that mean? Well, this is what it means. Though not only does God reveal Himself that He exists, not only does He communicate to people who have recognize His existence and rejected Him, but now you go a step further and He becomes a part of that race of human being, that creation, he takes that on. The power of the praise of the glory of his grace is unfathomable. And so that's what makes contentment possible. When we are keeping all of these truths, these facts of existence in the front of our mind, that's why no matter what may come, whether it be, we're going to sing a song this morning. It's interesting that we were going through the lyrics on this. Whether good or ill, and I want you to think about this as we're singing this song this morning called I Know Whom I Have Believed. And we get down to a verse that Bill, so I appreciate him doing this. It wasn't in the book, but it's part of the song. And Bill, so we're going to sing off the screen this morning. And we're going to get to this verse that says, I don't know what's going to come, whether it be good or ill, but whatever it is, Christ is going to be with me. Do not take that for granted. Do not take that for granted that no matter what happens, Christ is going to be with me. Because in the back of all of that is everything we've talked about this morning. And so that's why it's so, being discontent with Christ is such rebellion against God. Lusting after something that God has determined to not be what is best for me, that's why cosmically this is so crazy that we do this. But that's our nature. And so that's why we have to consciously be coming in and confessing and saying, Lord, I know that my heart is against you in this. I know that my heart is in rebellion against you with this. And I recognize that, I confess that, and I'm asking you to please overcome that. I'm asking you to change that, to sanctify that, to purge me of these things so that my mind and my heart are as pure as they can be through your power, through your grace, not through anything I'm doing, but through your grace. And so in all of that context, I want to move on into the remainder of this section in this chapter. And the reason that I went through all of this morning is because I want to protect us, as we were doing a couple weeks ago, from misapplying this section on divorce. Okay? Because Christ goes in, he's talked about if you look on a woman to lust after her, you've committed adultery already. We spent plenty of time talking about how that is a much broader concept than just porneia. And now we've got to do the same thing here in this section where it's talking about divorce, because he's not speaking inherently about marriage here. All right, so down on verse 31, I believe it's where it comes in. Yeah. Verse 31, it hath been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. All right, so let's just stop right there and let's talk about what that meant. In Jewish law, there were two things that would come with this writing of divorcement. Now, does anybody want to take a stab at what are the stipulations or the let's back up just a minute. Let's just back up for a second. What are some of the reasons? It gives fornication. We're going to take that one off the table. All right, we already know that one. But what are some of the other reasons that divorce was allowed under Jewish law, in the Jewish culture, at Christ's time all the way back to Moses? Under Moses' time, and because it had progressed. So under Moses' time, what are some of the reasons that someone could get a divorce?
Unfaithfulness.
Yep. So adultery on the part of. Now let me ask you this: could a woman file for divorce? No, a woman could never file for divorce under Jewish law, but a man could. So why? Adultery, unfaithfulness is one reason why a man could file, could give his wife a letter of divorcement. What else?
I don't think he had to have a reason way back.
He didn't. He could. The reason was any reason he wanted. That's what it came down to. Any reason he wanted, she don't keep house, she burns the biscuits, she won't sleep with me as much as I want her to. My kids are a bunch of little heathens, and she's in charge of them, and they disrespect me.
Found out she was unfaithful prior to the marriage.
Yep, find out she was unfaithful prior to the marriage. Yeah, we're going to get to that one in just a minute. There's a specific example of that one, right? Okay, so those are the reasons why. So now in the letter of divorcement, he gives this to her. There's two things that this does. One, it is a declaration that she is no longer his wife, and so she is, quote unquote, back on the market, right? Because up to that point, she is his wife, and anything that goes on. The other thing that it does in the divorcement, and this was completely up to the individual. The man could, in the letter of divorcement, could agree to some sort of material support for this woman for some amount of time up to and including the rest of her life. Okay, so this is where the most well-known example of divorce in the Bible that didn't actually happen, but it's in there, is Joseph and Mary. So Joseph, when he finds out that Mary is pregnant, it says he's going to put her away privately. So what that meant was, is he was going to write her a letter of divorcement. And this is what's so important about him about it saying he was going to put her away privately. He was going to financially support her for the rest of her life. Even though he was writing her a divorcement, he was going to include in that he would take care of her financially for the rest of her life. Now that's why Joseph was considered to be such an honorable individual in all of this, because even though he had nothing to do with this, he was going to still take care of her. Men could do that. They could write into the divorcement some sort of what we would call today alimony, right? Some sort of a material support for her for either some amount of time up to and including the rest of her life until she got remarried, whatever. So Jesus comes in here, and what he's focusing on in this is this desire that we have when we realize that we are, let's go back to this concept of lust, all right? So this is why in this entire section, he could have used, I'm going to put for consumption, he could have used any avenue, any facet of life in this. Houses, careers, families. We talked about all those things last time, but he doesn't. He uses this overall concept of marriage. And when he's talking about this divorcement, what he's honing in on is how our mind will try to justify our discontentment. We will try to rationalize it. That's the word I wanted to use more than justify. We will try to rationalize our discontentment and our lust to go after something else. So it would go like this. I have been married to Katrina for, it's going to be 25 years in July. I've given her the best quarter century of my life. She should be completely thankful that I have hung around as long as I have, that I have provided for her everything that I could provide for her. But as with all vehicles, it's time to trade one in. And so I'm going to write her this letter of divorce. Now look, guys, don't judge me. I'm going to take really good care of her, okay? It's just, you know, I'm much more marketable now than I was at 18. I have a much better job. I am now to the point where I can care for a much better version. And now everybody laughs, but look, this is how what I'm describing to you is going through tens of thousands of minds this morning. Tens of thousands of people, both men and women, somewhere in the world today are thinking through everything that I am articulating right now. Because that's how our brain works. And so we rationalize it and we say, I'm going to go ahead and do this, right? Thinking back to my analogy of Thin Mints last time. I know I don't need this. Yeah, thank you, because I'm getting low, right? I know, because I cannot tell you the number of men and women that I have worked with over the last 21 years that this is exactly the thought process they went through. I know I don't need him, but I want him. I know I don't need her, but I want her. And so, what was the guy? He was a singer back in the 80s, a country singer back in the 80s. I think it's T. Graham
Brown.
And he sung a song about, you know which one I'm talking about. He sings a song, the hardest thing I'll ever do
is loving her
and holding you. And the second hardest thing I'll ever, yeah, that's right. We all know it. Don't act like you don't know what these words are. The second hardest thing I'll ever do is telling her about you, right? She's been good to me when things were going rough. She's been, when good ain't good enough or something like that, right? So, but you see, but that, I mean, that mindset has always been around, and we will rationalize it. We will rationalize it, and we will come up with some reason why we can have our cake and eat it too. Why we can work through this, and we're gonna make this discontentment okay. And so Christ knows that he's dealing with people sitting in this crowd, including his very own apostles, whose minds work this way, and he says he kills this immediately. And so in 32, just as he has shocked their system up in 28 by telling them, you are committing an grievous sin, an egregious offense against the law when you look on a woman to consume her. When you look on another life to consume that life, you are devouring that life. And now he brings it home again in this section, and he says, you think you're just going to rationalize this, and you think that you are going to just put her away and take good care of her and make yourself feel warm and fuzzy as you go off and chase your desires and your hungers. You think you're going to be able to do that? You listen to me. You start down that path, and you have already gone to the nth degree, to the pinnacle, or to the bottom of the pit, whichever way you want to look at it. You have jumped in with both feet, and you have sunk yourself over your head in quicksand. And I'm telling you, he's looking at these people and he's saying, I'm telling you that if you write that letter of divorcement, if you turn her loose because you want to go chase something else, you have already committed adultery in your life, and you might cause her to do the same thing. And so now, I mean, he's putting this right in these guys' laps. Right in their laps. And I think, and you know, even to the point, it might have been that his disciples, you know, Peter's married, right? Peter's married. Well, let me ask you this. What if you leave your wife for Jesus? What if you leave your wife for Jesus? What if you're Peter and you say, I can't follow Jesus and take care of my family. I cannot go and be everything and with him everywhere while my wife is dragging me down through this. Is that justified? I'm going to write her a letter of divorcement and turn her loose so that I can go and devote all of my time to ministry. And to Jesus. Maybe I don't write her a letter of divorcement. Maybe I just we're not going to get a divorce, but I tell you what I'm going to do. Now, you think about this with pastors today. I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm not going to write you a letter of divorcement, but I'm also going to put my relationship with you as your husband and the father of our children way back here on the back burner, and I'm going to go focus entirely on ministry. I'll give you the example that pops into my head on this is a man named A.W. Tozer, who I respect A.W. Tozer's writings, and I think he was very good in the books that he wrote and his theology, but A.W. Tozer nearly starved his family to death. because he would travel around the entire country doing revivals, and when the church would come up and give him money, want to give him, pay him for being there that week, he would take the money and give it and hand it back to the church and say, I don't need it. Well, of course, he doesn't need it because he's sitting in a hotel room or at someone's house and they're feeding him. But his wife, he had five sons. And his wife, they had to go out and beg people in the community for food because A.W. Tozer would not send money home to take care of them. That's exactly right. So I read A.W. Tozer's writings on the Bible and on theology, but I reject the way he lived his life completely. Because no, you can't. He caused her to go out and find other people to do what he should have been doing as a husband. And you have to take everything. And so you're like, okay, this gets really confusing and really complex. It does. It does get confusing and complex, and that's why we have to come in saying, man, I'm completely inadequate for this. Because the reason that A.W. Tozer did that was because Christ became not just his Lord, but Christ became something that he wanted to consume. The ministry, when I say Christ, let me back it up. I don't want to say that. That was a mistake. Let me back this up. Christ was not something he wanted to consume. Ministry was something that he wanted to consume. It was no different in what he was doing, even though Jesus is at the top of the letterhead, it was no different than a man who owns, say, a garage or some sort of a business, a dry cleaners, whatever. And that man sinks himself into that business for the consumption of the prestige and everything that goes with owning that business. It was no different, even though Jesus is the one that's over the door. The church is the one that's over the door. It's still a matter of what's your heart, what's your desire in this? Are you lusting after something? Are you desiring in your heart for consumption? And no matter how much you try to rationalize putting everything else in your life secondary to that, to chase this one thing, you are lusting to the point of adultery in whatever aspect of your life that is, rather than being content with everything that God has given you. And we see this, we see these really large examples of this in celebrity all the time, whether it be in celebrity with Hollywood or be celebrity in ministry. We see this all the time where these, you know, you have what looks to be the perfect life until you start chipping away at it, right? What were the Kennedys called? Camelot? Is that right? Camelot, that was what they referred to the Kennedy administration as? Do what?
The Camelots of the modern time.
Yeah. Yeah. Because why? It looked, man, it looked perfect. Their stinking kids were all cute. This is, you know, I think about what's the two over in England right now, William and Kate. They got the most attractive little kids. Not one little ugly mongrel in the bunch, right? It's like you almost think that they like were leaving the hospital. And like we need to flip. We need to trade because these kids have to be the prettiest in the country. You think that's what it really looks like? Probably not. They have the same problems as everybody. They probably have more problems than everybody else. But it all looks like everything's going great on the outside, this Fabergé egg, and then you get on the inside and it's the same issues that everybody deals with. And we try to pursue after all of these things. Jordan's talked about this so many times. If you seek happiness, if you seek pleasure, you're never going to find it. You will never find happiness pursuing happiness. Happiness comes, I don't even like the word, because happiness comes from, is based on the same word as happenstance, and it's all about the conditions you're in. I prefer joy. Joy is unconditional. You can have joy in any situation. You cannot be happy in any situation, but you can have joy in any situation. And so look over at Psalms chapter 5. This is one that I've been working on this past week. And you get down here to these last couple of verses in Psalms chapter 5. 11 and 12. And this is the key to the whole thing. But let all those that put their trust in thee rejoice. All right, so think about what this word rejoice means. Rejoice means to articulate joy. When you rejoice, whether it be in singing, whether it be in some sort of praise, whether it be in just a smile on your face, rejoice means to articulate joy. But let all those that put their trust in thee rejoice. Let them ever shout for joy, because thou defendest them. Let them also that love thy name be joyful in thee. Why? For thou, Lord, will bless the righteous. With favor will thou compass him as with a shield. So now go up and look at the contrast to this. All right, look at verse 9 and 10. Matter of fact, let me go up to... I started to just teach this psalm this morning, just the truth of it, because this is so fascinating in this whole discussion that we're having. Let me just do that. I got 15 minutes. I want to go through this whole psalm with you. Go back up to the very beginning. Give ear to my words, O Lord. Consider my meditation. Hearken unto the voice of my cry, my King and my God, for unto thee will I pray. My voice shall thou hear in the morning, O Lord. In the morning will I direct my prayer unto thee and will look up. Now, he begins here in these first three verses. He's opening up about how he is starting his day. And he's coming to God. He's coming to the Lord and he's saying, I have to start my day in prayer. I have to start my day coming before you. There is no way that I am going to be able to go one step further until I come to you and I lay all of this out. This is that adoration. Okay? Now look at what he says in 4. This is why he has to come to God. For thou art not a God that hath pleasure in wickedness, neither shall evil dwell with thee. The foolish shall not stand in thy sight. Thou hatest all workers of iniquity. Thou shalt destroy them that speak leasing. The Lord will abhor the bloody and deceitful man. Now look at 7. 7 and 8 are the keys to the entire psalm. But as for me, I will come into thy house in the multitude of thy mercy, and in thy fear will I worship toward thy holy temple. This is so critical. Look at what the psalmist is saying here. He is not coming by the multitude of his righteousness. He is not coming by the multitude of his goodness or the multitude of his talents or the multitude of his beauty or the multitude of anything but God's mercy. So he is beginning his day by saying, you hate all of these things and the only thing I've got on my side is your mercy. The only reason that I'm coming into your house is not because I'm good. It's not because I am righteous. It's not because I'm wise. It's not because I'm honest. It's because you are bringing me here in the multitude of thy mercies. And I am worshiping toward your holy temple in your fear. Well, where did that come from? God granted that. So I'm coming to you, Lord, verses 1 through 3. I'm coming to you in the morning. I'm lifting up my voice to you because I know that you're the only thing that keeps me from being what is in 4, 5, and 6. That's confession. The only thing that keeps me from being 4, 5, and 6 is 7. But as for me, I will come into thy house in the multitude of thy mercy, and in thy fear will I worship toward thy holy temple. There is no rationalization. There is no justification. This psalmist, David, in this case, is confessing that it is only through you, Lord, that I'm going to be able to stand. So therefore, what's his plea? Lead me, O Lord, in thy righteousness because of mine enemies. Make thy way straight before my face. So all of these enemies that he's talking about, this is not necessarily those who are trying to kill him, those who are trying to bring him physical injury or harm. But when you look at 9, at the way that he describes these, for there is no faithfulness in their mouth. Their inward part is very wickedness. Their throat is an open sepulcher. They flatter with their tongue. Destroy thou them, O God. Let them fall by their own counsels. Cast them out in the multitude of their transgressions, for they have rebelled against thee. So do you see the people that he's calling his enemies are the ones that are trying to draw him away from God? Whether it be counselors, whether it be people on the business side of his life, whether it be anybody that is coming to him that is not faithful in their mouth. Anyone that is coming to him that is deceitful in their inner part. Anyone whose throat is an open sepulcher. Anyone who is trying to flatter him with their tongue. They are in rebellion against God. So you think about that and you look and you put that in the 21st century context. The enemies that he's speaking of in 9, that's every advertiser in America. Every commercial, every billboard, every enticement. And for me, this is one of the things that I do in my own mind. When I'm thinking through these Psalms and David is writing about his enemies, I always include in that spiritual enemies, demons. I always include in that. So when I read this and it's talking about David is writing about his enemies, the first place that I always start when I'm putting that my mind to that is Satan and all of his forces, all of his powers and principalities in the air. Those are the first enemies that I look at. And so when I come to 10 and I say, destroy thou them, I don't want God to destroy any human being, but I hope he destroys every demon in the army. I want them to fall. I want them off of me. Destroy thou them, O God. Let them fall by their own counsels. All of those demonic influences that are trying to woo me and push me off, let them fall by their own counsel. Cast them out in the multitude of their transgressions, for they have rebelled against thee. And those things are around me all the time. 9 and 10 are constantly trying to influence me into the ditch, into a pit. And so I have to go back up to 8 and say, because of that, because there's no faithfulness in their mouth, because there is wickedness in their inward part, because they are evil through and through, lead me, O Lord, in thy righteousness because of mine enemies. Make thy way straight before my face, because everything is stacked against me. Everything is stacked against my discipleship to Christ. Everything in this entire universe outside of God Himself wants me to fail. Everything wants me to fail except God. So I'm asking Him, I'm praying this every morning before I even can get out of my bed. Lead me, O Lord, in thy righteousness, because I'm completely surrounded by enemies. Because of my enemies, make thy way straight before my face. And then you come down to 11. And the contrast between all of these that are deceitful and unfaithful to God, these are in rebellion against Him. But let those who are super good, let those who are uber Christians, no. But let those that put their trust in thee rejoice. This lust for consumption is the exact opposite, the dichotomy of putting my trust in God. So this, everything that we've talked about in this entire section is the exact opposite of what verse 11 says. But let all those that put their trust in thee rejoice. Lord, I know I bring nothing to this, but I'm trusting you. I'm trusting that you're going to change my eyes. I'm trusting you're going to change my hands. I'm trusting you're going to change my heart. You're going to change my mind. You are going to come in and intervene within me so that I have godliness with contentment, which is what did we call that last time we were together? What is that? Godliness with contentment is great gain. Exactly right. So God, I'm depending on you. I'm putting my trust in you that you are going to give me both godliness and contentment in my life. And when I do that, then I will be able to articulate joy. Let them ever shout for joy because you defend them. Not because of anything within them, not because of anything that they bring, but because you are the one who's standing in their way. You're the one defending them. You're the one bringing them into your house through the multitude of your mercies. And that is why we rejoice. That is why we get to shout for joy, because I have the one who is undefeated defending me. Let them also that love thy name be joyful in thee. For thou, Lord, will bless the righteous. With favor will thou compass him as with a shield. So this psalm, Psalm 5, I mean, everything that that David is writing here, he's writing because he's writing in the same spirit that Christ is communicating in this section of Matthew chapter 5. This idea of being content, of knowing everything that God can bring to us and how much we need Him and how desperate we are for His intervention and for His grace. And so the same spirit that is inspiring Christ to put this into stark view for His disciples is the same spirit that's sitting here on David's shoulder, in David's ear, as he is living this out in through Psalm chapter 5. Has anybody got anything this morning? I know we've covered a lot.
It's not a sum total, but I think what we see in the service where it's described this, I guess, is that even religion today does this. They view the flesh as being the threat and not the heart.
Amen. You're right. Yep. Yeah, there's nothing inherently wrong. You know, when he says, when Paul says, there is within me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing, that's because it's the heart. The flesh is really neutral. That's just my own strength and my own abilities to do things. And where that becomes a problem is when that's what I'm depending on. But God gave me this flesh, right? He gave me a brain. He gave me the ability to think. He gave me a mouth and the ability to articulate. He gave me strength and the ability to move my body and to be in places and to do things. All of those are good. Those are blessings from God, every bit of that. And you don't think so? Wait till you don't have one of those things. Till you don't have a mind. Till you don't have a voice. Till you don't have a body. So those things are good when put into the service of the Lord. But where they fall apart is when we try to do all of these things, live this life and make all of these decisions and actions in the power of the flesh, in our own power and our own strength, and then it all falls apart. But it comes back to what is going on in the heart. Because what happens if you discipline the flesh, but you don't change the heart?
Martin Luther will tell you about
that. Yeah, Martin Luther will tell you about that. You get to the point where you hate God. Mm-hmm. You hate God because God has given you a rule book that's unachievable. And so you get so frustrated because you can't accomplish the things that God has given you to do, and you just throw your hands up and say, you're unfair. And God says, I'm not unfair because I gave you the completion of it. I gave you the fulfillment of the law. It's called Jesus Christ, and it's sitting there, and it's yours to take. But that's why God is not unjust. And we could get into three whole chapters on Romans about why God is not unjust in the way that He set things up, because He's given us righteousness through Jesus Christ, and it's there for us to accept and to put over us so that our flesh suddenly can be something that's profitable through Christ.
I don't want to labor on it, but you know, that's what happened with Adam and Eve when Satan came to them. He said, you're not surely die. So, did they die when they ate of the fruit? Well, he told them something, but that wasn't the whole truth.
Right.
And that's what we do a lot of times with the flesh versus the heart. We accept the surface of it, but not the in-depthness of it.
Amen. Exactly right. All right. So next week, we will pick up then on chapter 11 in the book and Matthew 5:33 through 37.